Morning. It's good to be with you here this morning. My name is Andy, and I'm a pastor here at Grace Bible Church, Midtown. I did have one concern as I was enjoying that moment on the other side of the curtain now, being here and voting on a teaching pastor. And I do think maybe there's something we need to do about some of these basic last names. So the Smiths and the Thompsons were just lacking Jones, Brown, Williams, something like that. It's maybe something, an area we need to look at. It'd be probably enough for some of us to be willing to change our names or something. But that's a little detail, I think, for the next guy. We're going to have to work on that. It's a privilege to share the word. And I think it was actually my daughter a few weeks ago that told me I needed to talk about Esther at some point this summer. So it's more than that, but she highly recommended this particular narrative, and we're going to tackle it this morning. But I'll confess that my study over the last 2 weeks was very challenging. This is a beautiful story. It's one of the ones I loved listening to as a child, but it's actually a little more complicated once you get into it, especially as an adult, when you look at the story and you try to put yourself in the place of some of the people in the story, it becomes a whole lot more complicated. So we're going to trust the Lord as we approach his word to give us understanding. So Esther, beautiful, beautiful story. I think Hollywood has maybe made a couple of horrible interpretations of it. I'm not sure. I haven't watched them, so I can't judge the merits of it. All I'm getting at is this, is Esther is not a Disney princess story, okay? That's not what we have going on here at all. The Disney princess stories, there's like a formula, right? They follow a certain path. So there's a frustrated young lady. She maybe is just misunderstood. Perhaps she's an orphan. She dreams of a better life beyond her circumstances, and she yearns for more. And then she faces adversity. It's an evil stepmother. It's a spell. It's an evil ruler, but there's something she comes up against. But she remains kind and brave and true to herself. And there's some good stuff going on there. I'm just, you know, making some comparisons here. So then she has the help of magical creatures, loyal friends, inner strength, and she rises to the occasion, and she embarks on a transformative journey. That's the way it normally works. Along the way, she discovers love, usually a charming prince, but more importantly, she finds her own voice and her own power. So, I mean, he's a nice accessory, so to speak. It's the way it works. Good triumphs over evil. The young lady's dreams come true, and it ends happily ever after. That's kind of the formula. Now, if you've actually gone and read some of the books that the Disney princesses were based on, then you're in for another thing altogether. So I don't know about you, but my mother committed the terrible mistake, I think we were still in grade school, of reading The Little Mermaid to us. Horrible. Horrible story. That is something you should never do to a young child. You should traumatize them. So on the one hand, you have some of those horrible fairy tales that are not true to life, not for the life of someone who trusts in God. But then you have the Disney princesses that aren't very true to life either, and they certainly have nothing to do with Esther. So get that out of your mind. Let's not even think about that. This is a different story, so to speak. So Esther, we have a lot to learn from her. One of the phrases that always comes to mind when I think of Esther is, for such a time, that God had his unique purposes and that he put her in a specific place and time with something specific to do and something specific to show us. But I think the key to understanding this very difficult book is to remember that though he is not even named, the real protagonist is working behind the scenes to rescue his people. That is what helps us make sense of this book. It's not that you have these characters that keep experiencing good luck. It's you have these characters who have a gracious God, even, again, if he's not named. So you see all these things going on in the book, and you can either choose to read it as a piece of literature where there's a lot of coincidence, or you can choose to see the unnamed God and see the hand of providence, the good hand of God in all of this. So that's the challenge we have before us. Now, I'm going to do something different. We're going to have some points at some point, but I think that I can't just assume that everyone knows the story in some of the gritty detail. So we're going to tackle, I don't even know if they make them anymore, but they used to be these Cliff Notes things that you could do. I think now you'd use AI or whatever, and it spits out a summary. But we used to have these things called Cliff Notes, which was the basic summary version. So I'm going to tackle that. I'm going to hit a lot of verses. I'll try to read them. I'll try to go slowly. But that's what we're going to attempt. All right. Let's start off at the beginning. We're going to skip over some of the incredible detail about this tremendous party that they're having in Esther chapter 1. But let's just stick to some of the basics. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command that was delivered by his eunuchs. The king became furious, livid, and his anger burned within him. So the queen, I think a rational person, declines an invitation to show herself at a drunken party that's been going on for weeks on end. So I'm not sure what's going on here, and frankly, I read a lot of studious people, and frankly, they don't know what's going on here either. The details are hard to pin down, but she was either the trophy wife that was going to be put on display or something worse. None of it is good. So this reasonable, I think, I'm interpreting, woman, declines an invitation to show up at this drunken party with all these rulers from across the kingdom. I think she's on track, but the king doesn't think so. He becomes livid and furious. Then we move on a little bit further, a few verses. For the queen's action, this is the concern of these wise advisors that the king has. The queen's action will become public knowledge to all the women and cause them to despise their husbands and say, King Ahasuerus ordered Queen Vashti brought before him, but she did not come. So we're giving this insight. Was someone there? I don't know how it went down. But the king is so offended. He's so insecure. He really is so pathetic. That's one of the takeaways from this book, that he calls his counselors and he's like, what are we going to do? And then it's like the curtain is pulled back and we get to hear this pathetic discussion of these insecure men talking about how this is going to affect all the men in the kingdom. So it's almost silly, and yet it's strangely comforting too, I think, sometimes for us. When we feel sometimes like the powers that be on the global stage are such powerful people and they can just do things as they please. When the curtain is pulled back, you see that many times these rulers are weak, they are insecure, they're having to receive advice from foolish people, and ultimately our confidence is never going to be in them. It's going to be in the king and the sovereign of the universe. That to me is comforting. So you take back, peel back the curtain, you get to see what power really looks like. It's not that impressive, and you take comfort from that. So the king deposes the queen after this ridiculous board meeting with his advisors. Then the king, he's feeling a bit sorry for himself after a few months, I think it is. And so they're trying to encourage him. What does he do next? And the advice is, let the king appoint commissioners in each province of his kingdom so that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem at the fortress of Susa. Then the young woman who pleases the king will become queen instead of Vashti. This suggestion pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Let me just stop and make a little parenthesis here. If you want to find a book full of faithfully recorded bad advice, Esther's the book for you. So it's like the whole crazy book. It's just one person giving bad advice after another. I even think that maybe Mardoqueo, what is it in English? Mordecai. Even he maybe gives some bad advice, okay? So this is a book chock full of bad advice, and here's some more. So the king agrees to this pathetic beauty contest to find a new queen. That must have really massaged his ego. Not sure what the deal was, but it's terrible when you think about it. Moving on. Then we find that Esther somehow ends up in this pathetic beauty contest. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. So she ends up in the beauty contest. She wins the pageant, ridiculous thing that is what that it was, and she ends up with the crown on her head. These are the kind of the places where you have questions and you have no one to ask. I can't interview Mordecai. I can't interview Esther. I don't know how this went down. This is just a faithful recording of what happened. But as you imagine the circumstances, it's incredibly distasteful to think of what was involved. She's queen. And then there's an episode that seems unimportant as you're reading the book, but then it comes back to be a very, very important detail in the book. We have Mordecai, Esther's uncle, who learns of a plot to kill the king. He reports it to Queen Esther, and she tells the king on Mordecai's behalf. So all of a sudden, Esther is becoming very important. She becomes the spokesperson and the go-between. And very importantly, Mordecai does this goodness, this kindness for the king, and the king, not accidentally, doesn't reward him. No reward, no honors, no congratulations, and the story just moves on. So it's a weird parenthesis, unless you see how the story is going to go from there. Then we have another case where I would love to interview Mordecai and find out what he was thinking and what he's getting at. Mordecai manages to offend a powerful local ruler. When Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying him homage, he was filled with rage. What's the dynamic there? I don't know. There's something very interesting, though, and that is that Haman is a descendant of the enemies of Saul, and Mordecai is a descendant of Saul. There's a dynamic going on there, but it's not enough to fully understand why he's refusing to bow when he probably bowed to the king and bowed to others. That's something we just don't know. So he manages to offend a very powerful local ruler. Haman, the local ruler, he plots violent revenge. And this guy really is sick because he's incredibly upset at this man that won't bow to him. But it's not going to satisfy him to just take Mordecai out. He's going to take out everyone related to Mordecai. Not his immediate family, not his extended family, but everyone that shares his ethnicity he wants to wipe out. So this guy is absolutely crazy. It'll be Mordecai and all the Jewish people by the time he's done with things. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, it seemed repugnant to Haman to do away with Mordecai alone. He couldn't swallow just getting rid of Mordecai. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom. This all happens, becomes law, because Haman manages to get to the king and manipulate him. This ruler, there's not much good to say about him. He doesn't know what to do, gets terrible advice. He gets manipulated. Here, take my signet ring, do whatever you want with it. And then he does it again later in the book. You have to wonder about a tremendous historic empire that was ruled by such a weak, insecure man. And yet, these things are that way sometimes. So, Haman informs the king, there is one ethnic group, doesn't name it. He's very wise about how he goes about this. Scattered through the peoples in every province of your kingdom, keeping themselves separate. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If you think about that, you'll be reminded of some of the false accusations that the religious leaders made against Jesus, teaching them not to obey, not to honor the king. It's very interesting how the lies are repeated. And this is how he manages to get the king to give him permission to carry out one of the many situations where someone wanted to do ethnic cleansing. This gets translated into multiple languages. It gets sent out on speedy horses throughout the kingdom. It reaches everywhere except evidently Esther. Where she's at, she doesn't have news. But Mordecai finds out about it. And he reaches out to Esther. He encourages her to intervene on behalf of her people. She initially says, hey, no one can go before the king without being invited. That's taking life into your own hands. But eventually he does persuade her. She's reluctant, but she later agrees to risk her life, to put her life on the line. If I perish, I perish, which are some of the memorable words in the book. So she gives instructions to Mordecai, go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. After that, I will go to the king, even if it is against the law. If I perish, I perish. Something beautiful about that. There is kind of a faint, limited foreshadowing of the ultimate Savior, Jesus Christ, who will come but will willingly lay down his life for the sheep in a much more fuller, comprehensive, loving, perfect way. But there's a faint foreshadowing in her willingness to risk her life for her people. That'll be done ultimately and perfectly by Jesus Christ one day. And that is, of course, our hope. Esther risks her life by going to the king. He hasn't called for her. And the king spares her life and accepts her invitation to a banquet. Haman is also invited. These are some of the things where I would love to have an interview and figure out what is going on. Not only is there a ton of bad advice in this book, there's a ton of banquets, just one after another. And here's a couple more banquets. And you don't know, there must be some theme. I'm not an English teacher. I can't figure out that stuff. But there's got to be something going on with some of this stuff. As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she gained favor with him. The king extended the golden scepter in his hand toward Esther, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. If that had not happened, her life would have been forfeit. She was taking her life into her own hands. Esther doesn't speak her mind. At the banquet, she invites them for a second banquet. Again, I would love to understand better what is going on. If I have found favor, she says to the king, in the eyes of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet I will prepare for them. Tomorrow, I will do what the king has asked. The king had asked, what can I do for you? Up to half the kingdom, what do you want? It will be given. And cryptically, she says, come back tomorrow for another banquet. Something is being set up. I don't understand exactly what it is. It's just too subtle for me. Haman is getting so annoyed. He leaves the banquet. He thinks he's amazing. After all, the queen only invited the king and me. I mean, there's no one bigger, no one greater. But that makes him incredibly annoyed. So he leaves again. There's Mordecai. He doesn't bow. And all the joy he could have had of being the special one dissipates by seeing that guy who refuses to honor him as he believes he should be honored. He gets home to his wife. She gives bad advice too. And all his friends told them, have them build a gallows 70 feet tall. Ask the king in the morning to hang Mordecai on it. Then go to the banquet and enjoy yourself. I mean, this is pretty sick when you think about it. The advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows constructed. So the kind of stuff that's going on is crazy. Again, this is not a Disney movie by any stretch of the imagination. So that happens. Bad advice has it built. It must have been built very quickly. And Haman comes to the king the next day to get permission because, you know, he's just so impatient. He can't wait to the date that's been decreed for the Jewish people to be purged. So he's getting ahead of himself. He wants to get the permission. But before he can get the permission, this is some of the stuff that makes you smile. The king has a matter for his special insight. He needs advice from Haman. So the king wants to know, how should I honor someone special? Haman can't think of anyone more special than himself, but the someone that's special is Mordecai. A very memorable turn of events that if you've read the story doesn't shock you as much, but just think about how that goes. Haman enters, the king asks him, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? Haman thought to himself, who would that be but me? And we have this surprising twist in the story. And what you have is Haman having to parade around town his mortal enemy Mordecai and has to honor him verbally. This is what will be done for the man that the king is pleased with. You probably can't imagine the depths of humiliation that an evil man like Mordecai would have experienced. So he takes the royal garment, he takes the horse, he clothes Mordecai and parades him through the city, calling out before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. Incredible twist and turn of events. Haman's family recognizes that his fortunes have changed. Superstitious, whatever the case may be. But the wife here gets it right. There's no advice. It's actually terrible. She basically says,
oops, game over. This isn't going to end well. But she's insightful, at least at this point. Haman told his wife and his friends. His wife said, since Mordecai is Jewish and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain. So she's actually one of the more insightful persons in this particular story. At the second banquet, the king tells, Esther tells the king what Haman has done. And she's very diplomatic. She says, hey, if they were just selling us into slavery, I wouldn't even mention it, but this is life or death. So she knows how to appease. I don't want to trouble you with something, you know, I'm so sorry, but this is life or death. She does it very, very well. So I think I might have skipped one ahead. And almost sadly, Haman blunders his way to his own gallows. I don't know if that's ironic. Again, I don't know how to use some of those words, but he builds the gallows, and in this scene, Esther accusing him before the king, he blunders his way all the way to his own gallows. One of the eunuchs helpfully pops up. This guy must have hated Haman. That's all I can think about. He must have hated Haman to utter this kind of advice. But he says, there's a gallows 75 feet tall at Haman's house that he made for Mordecai, the guy who saved the king. And the king, in his anger, in his fury, the Bible doesn't say that he does well. The Bible doesn't tell us in this point that anyone has done well. It's not like behavior is being recommended. But in his anger, the king says, go hang him on it, which is crazy, the change of fortunes between the guy who was so privileged, next in line under the king, hung on his own gallows. Then we have the king allowing Mordecai to take action to protect the Jewish people. It says, write in the king's name whatever pleases you concerning the Jews. That's why I have questions about this man's leadership. You know, this is why I wonder what's going on in his head. Seal it with a royal signet ring. A document written in the king's name and sealed with a royal signet cannot be revoked, which is part of the problem. It had been decreed that this ethnic cleansing could occur. What Mordecai has is the option to decree that the Jews are able to defend themselves. And because he's the powerful man in town, now all the local rulers, they want to be on the right side of Mordecai. And it ends up being an incredible change of events. And then we find out that the Jewish people, they violently protect themselves by loyal decree. Actually uses the word vengeance. The king's edict gave Jews in each city the right to assemble, defend themselves, destroy, kill, annihilate every ethnic and provincial army hostile to them, including women and children, to take their possessions as spoil of war. Incredibly harsh when you think about it. It says later that they don't take any spoil. They don't touch anything. And yet some of this stuff is difficult to consider from our vantage point, this side of the cross. And so you have a people, Esther, Mordecai, and all their people who are in peril, and now they are at peace. And this remarkable story that has nothing to do with what Disney creators, illustrators might think of. Because during those days, the Jews gained relief from their enemies. That was the month when their sorrow was turned into rejoicing and their mourning into a holiday. There were to be days of feasting, rejoicing, and of sending gifts to one another and to the poor. So we have this remarkable story. And now we're going to take the time that remains. I'm going to keep an eye on the clock. And we're just going to basically ask ourselves two questions. We're going to ask ourselves, I'm going to start with what we don't know. I've already alluded to some of the stuff we don't know. I think it's arrogant to presume because we have limited information that we're working with. And then we want to ask ourselves, what do we know and what's our takeaway? What do we do with that? Okay? So we'll take the time that remains and we'll answer these two questions partially because the list of what we don't know is incredibly long, so I just abbreviated it. We're not going to go there. The list of what we do know is also long. I'm just going to focus on a few things. So what don't we know? Well, I think we don't know quite a few things, but let's focus on the main things. The main thing, the most difficult thing to ascertain is, why is God not mentioned in this book? Now, I remember hearing stories when I was younger. It was always the one theory. But, you know, it's perhaps not fully satisfying as a theory. That theory is that the book was written in political circumstances that were such that they couldn't attribute this rescue to God. That always made sense to me growing up. It was just that, you know, conditions weren't right. They couldn't give God the credit for this remarkable rescue. He couldn't be named. It doesn't satisfy me as much anymore, but that could be. That is plausible. But we don't know exactly why he's not named. Now, is it some kind of literary device, a clever way of leaving him out to highlight him? Well, that's very complicated, but maybe that could be. It wasn't like these people were ignorant. They knew how to craft a story. They were educated, maybe more intelligent than we are. So maybe someone, that is the way of exalting the one who's obviously there but not even named. I don't know. Or there's a third option. Is this some kind of faithless or apostate Jew writing this book? Is he more focused on his ethnicity than the God of the promises and the God of the covenant? I don't know. I just don't know. And it's hard to understand perhaps where that would go. Now let's move on to another great question that I don't have a great answer to. This is not the way you're supposed to do it. You're not supposed to leave unanswered questions, but that's what I have for you. It's assignment. It's homework. Second question is, how does a devout Jewish person avoid being identified as Jewish? How does that work? Mordecai tells Esther, don't tell them your ethnicity. Keep quiet about your ethnicity. That means that there were some adverse effects. It wasn't a good thing to be known as belonging to a certain ethnicity. My grandfather was born and raised in a small city in Alberta, Canada, that up until when he was in his teenage years, the language was German at church, at home, and in the public square. And then because of stuff that happened on the global stage, it became imperative to not speak German anymore. So it was a matter of months where everything radically changed. And they no longer wanted to identify as German, or in this case, German and Danish. Something's going on here. It's not convenient to be Jewish. But here's my question. Don't you remember Daniel? They offered him food. It wasn't kosher. And what did he say? He said, no, not touching that. I'm not being served that. So what happens to Esther in the harem, in the palace, being served food? The Jews have been commanded not to partake of. What does she do? How does that look like? How do you hide your ethnicity as a devout Jew? I don't know exactly how you pull that off. Or do you remember the Jewish marriage laws? Who were they supposed to and not marry? It was very clear. And Israel sinned time and time again because they married who they should not have been marrying. So I don't know how this works. How does a devout Jew fake not being a Jew? I don't think you can pull it off very well. And finally, and related to that, the question is, how is it, perhaps, could it be, have Mordecai and Esther been forced into this situation? Like there was really no other way out. There was no other way out. Now, I look at the book of Daniel and I say, yes, but God saved these people out of no way out situations too. I can't judge. I just don't know. I can't be certain. Did Haman have to disrespect? Did Mordecai have to disrespect this guy? I don't know. Did she have to go when the young ladies were called? I don't know. What I do know is that you look throughout Scripture, hiding who you are, hiding your identity. Remember Abraham twice? Say you're my sister. And then his son goes on and does the same dumb thing. It's never a good sign in the Scripture when you're hiding who you are. This is never viewed favorably. So I don't know exactly what that means. Let's move on from that. What do we know, or what can we take away? I think there's some things that I'm really going to want to know about the book of Esther when I get to heaven. I don't know if you have a running list of questions. These just moved way up on my list. I'm going to want to know about this stuff. But for now, I think we can be confident we do know some things. We know the important things. We know perhaps why this is included in God's revelation to us. And I think that revolves around a handful of questions. The first is, okay, who is the protagonist? It's named after Esther, right? But towards the end of the book, Mordecai, has become much more important, a source of joy and pride for the Jewish people. But I think the way to understand this book and not go crazy about all the stuff you don't know is to acknowledge first and foremost that the protagonist is God. He is not named, he is not acknowledged, but he is the protagonist. We don't know if these Jewish people are faithless or faithful. We know that God rescues them. So we're left with lingering questions, but not about who the gracious hand moving events is. That part we know. We have the faithful rescuer of faithful or faithless people, whatever the case may be. Now, we do have Mordecai in chapter 4, verse 14. He tells Ruth, hey, if salvation doesn't come through you, salvation is going to come through someone. But that confidence, is it a faith confidence or is it a superstitious ethnic confidence? Like when the Israelites would try to take the Ark of the Covenant out into battle, they weren't trusting in God. They just thought with their good luck charm they were going to get through. We don't know that. We're not confident. And then when you have Haman's family in chapter 6, they see that the unseen hand has turned against Haman, and this is not going to end well. He's not named, but he is recognized and acknowledged in some ways. What's the takeaway? The takeaway is that God is the real protagonist in the story of Esther. And similarly, God is the real protagonist in what I think of and you think of as my story or your story. And I think so many of our problems with our expectations and our approach to life is kind of this understanding that we are the protagonists and it's God who's playing a secondary character and helping me. So I think a lot of our expectations about God have to do with the twisted way in which we see this story. In English, there's that neat little his story thing that we do sometimes. But would we, if we could understand that he is the protagonist, he gets the credit, he gets the glory, I exist to enjoy him forever, how that could revolutionize the way I approach things. Sometimes the frustration is, this is the story I charted for my life. I get to my late 30s, 40s, early 50s, and the story hasn't gone like I should, and there's a measure of frustration that my cast isn't doing what it needs to do for me to shine and be the star that I need to be. But if he is the star, he is the protagonist, it is his story, and I am graciously allowed to be a part, then that changes our perspective radically. You have been created in his image. He has created. We have rebelled and gone our own way. He has rescued. And he's reconciling people to himself, having sent the perfect substitute to take our place. This is the amazing thing. He's the protagonist. It's his story. And the story is going to end well. So why wouldn't you want to be part of the cast? Why wouldn't you want to be part of a cast where the story truly is happily ever after? That doesn't cut it. Joyfully, gloriously ever after, whatever the case may be. But how much better to be part of a true success story than have to stumble through life with expectations that are not met? Also, God remains in complete control. You think Queen Vashti was deposed by accident? Do you think that Mordecai overhears the conversation by accident? Do you think that Esther finds favor time and time and time again, and this is by accident? None of this is by accident. When we read in the scripture that someone finds favor with God, that's just a code for God was gracious to this person. They didn't deserve it. God was gracious to this person. It's the way he deals with his creatures. There's too many coincidences in the story to not think that God is who's running the show. Haman uses something like dice to choose a day and a month, which is supposed to be the day for the death of these Jewish people, and it becomes the day they celebrate because it's the day of triumph. What? So he's rolling the dice, and yet God is directing the outcome of whatever happens. Haman builds a gallows to kill Mordecai, and he and his sons end up on that gallows. Mordecai, his reward for saving the king is delayed until just the right moment. These aren't coincidences. This is someone running things and fully in charge. What's the takeaway? The dice have been cast. No luck involved. Esther doesn't have good luck. She has a gracious God. God's people don't have good luck. They have a gracious God. God's purposes will not be prevented by evil men. God's purposes will not be hampered by our foolish choices. He remains and always will be in complete control. And that should be great comfort to us. Silly rulers may plot and conspire, but the protagonist rules. And that is amazing. Proverbs 16 says it well. Some of you probably thought of this verse as I was saying this. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Chaotic universe we live in, there is someone in control. And finally, God cares for his people. I think there's some insight in Psalm 6. I'm just going to run through this very quickly. Psalm 6, it says that though Israel sinned greatly, God, for the love of his name, rescued them. So it wasn't a merit-based rescue. It was just God being gracious to foolish, faithless, rebellious people, and that pattern continues. And then later on in Psalm 46, it says that God remembers his covenant with them and gives them favor in the eyes of their captors. That happens to Daniel. That happens to the young men. It happens to Esther as well. God remembers. They maybe don't remember, but he remembers them. God cares for his people. So what's the takeaway? Trust his purposes. He cares for his people. You can trust his hand. You can follow his will. You can do right and not fear man. And this is the last thing I want to leave that's probably important, and that is don't judge yet. So how many times during the story of Esther could you have paused, looked at the landscape, and thought, what on earth is going on? Where is this going? Where will rescue come from? And you would have judged wrong because you don't know the end of the story. You don't know where this is going. We, of course, have read the story many times and have an understanding. So you may be tempted to analyze your circumstances and pass judgment on God. And that temptation you must fight at all costs. You must go to God, consider him and his perfections, and then judge your circumstances, and you'll have things in the right order. We don't judge God by the circumstances. We judge the circumstances by what we know of God. And that's so important. So you may be frustrated. You don't see his hand in your circumstances. Don't jump to any conclusions, even when he is not seen. The protagonist is active behind the scenes. He is good. He is wise. He is strong. He does not tire. He doesn't miss a thing. So he may not be named, but God rescues in his time, in his way, for his glory, and such hope is ours. I want to invite now our deacons to prepare. We're going to transition right into a time of remembrance, a time of memorial. Let me read verse 28 of chapter 9 of Esther. These days are remembered and celebrated by every generation, family, province, and city, so that these days of Purim will not lose their significance in Jewish life, and their memory will not fade from their descendants. So this day of deliverance became a memorial. We, as New Covenant people, we have our own memorial. We have our own celebration. It's not a banquet. We don't indulge or overdo it, but we have our own memorial. This morning, we remember how we were rescued. We stood condemned. We were helpless. We were rescued. We take the bread, we take the cup, and we remember that a righteous substitute took our place. And so we celebrate with thanksgiving and with expectation for the future. So if you belong to Jesus, if he's your only hope in life and death, if you're walking in harmony with God's people, then I invite you to remember together with the bread and with the cup. We're going to take a few moments now to examine ourselves as the elements are passed. I want to let you know that all the bread is gluten-free. Please don't be worried about dietary concerns. Take this moment to examine your heart and partake worthily, because by God's grace, you may partake worthily.